It's a pleasure and an honour to be here today. And I'm delighted to read with Rita Ann and Louis, both of whom I've admired their work from afar, but I never met them before. So that's an added bonus. I'd like to start with Dry Stone Wall. I'll skim the scraw, dig a trench wide and deep to hold the given stone. Lay silver grey against green, rocks with square planes to build off, slivers thin as slate to level in between. I'll lift the stones, test where they'll nestle into what's already there. Fill the middle with spalls, keep the edge stones from falling in. I'll use old stones, dappled with lichen and moss, leave gaps to let the wind blow through, nooks for pennyworth and heart's tongue to grow. I'll cover the joins, mind the batter, stack each course till it takes its place between two fields. Keep a few of the finest for the finish, long and flat capstones to span the width. I chose that poem to begin with because all three of us today happen to be from the West. And that's one of the things how I always know, because I live on the East now, but apart when you cross the Shannon, what you start to see is the dry stone walls, and it's how I know I'm home. I've been at a number of really good events this week here, and one of the ones I absolutely loved was John Parnham's one about ecopoetics. And it sent me looking at that question of, well, what kind of a nature poet am I? And I found this quote from Alice Oswald that I really liked. And she said, it's about nature poetry is about putting our inner worlds in contact with the outer world, a deep, slow process that used to be the remit of the rake. The Ringer. It was my mother taught me to watch blood-breasted stone chats on a barbed wire fence, to listen for the mournful song of a linnet, a meadow pipit's seeping alarm. I couldn't count how many I've caught, ringed, sexed, measured and weighed. But I'll always remember the first time in the woods beyond Skibbereen when I opened a mist net at dawn, held a goldcrest hammocked between finger and thumb, a rosebud in my palm. Olive nape, yellow crown, eyes black and glistening as Kilkenny marble. I held my breath lest I harm her. Turned my hand so she lay on her back. She settled as if lulled into a trance. I opened the cage of my fingers. A heartbeat, and she was gone. Stephen Sexton finished his lovely reading with a love poem just about an hour ago, and I thought I'd read a love poem as well. And this one, due to the wonder of marriage equality, my partner and I were able to get married last year, and but we'd been together a long time, so writing vows, I felt it wasn't with quite the innocence that you'd have when you write them maybe after 2 years or 3 years together. So 24 years later, these were my vows. Vows. I can't promise it's chiseled from gold in spirals that speak of forever. I can't tell you it's wise as a mountain with pines that reach for heaven. I can't promise it's flawless as honey, gathered by bees and bell heather. I can't say it's simple as silk, spun from cocoon into treasure. But I promise it's rooted as rowan, with berries that sing to September. I promise it's to and it's fro, with surprise like Glenmalure weather. A seasoned rowboat, moored or unmoored at your pleasure. When you come to put together a collection, it's amazing what you see in your work. It's really only when you pull it together like that that you begin to see things. And one of the things I saw is that my maternal grandmother found her way into these poems quite a lot. And this one, she lost her mother when she was six. And there was something about that I found so striking. I was always, you know, kind of wondering, you know, from a very young child, what that would have been like. And so this is imagining what that might have been like for her. Among the cows. Her father knew where to find her. She liked to stand among the cows. They smelled of winter and the dark. They let her lean into their warm bellies. She watched them in the fields as they moved solid and slow, wrapped their tongues around sweet grass. She found her own tune in their lowing, learned to milk as soon as her hands were strong enough to squeeze. When her mother died, her father wore his grief the way he wore his Sunday suit, as if it belonged to someone else. She would listen to the calves calling for days when weaned, until their voices, exhausted, faded like mist from the fields. In the last reading from the National Poetry Competition, Caleb and Tom as well, there was lots of lovely rhythm and rhyme, and that encouraged me to read this pantoum. And during the week, I've had two emails from Australia recently, one of whom is here. Alice Hamilton is here, who sent me an email about the river. But then I also got one from a woman who had grown up in Roscommon, and she said, I was one of the women on the boat amongst the 40,000 young people who left Ireland in 1960. On the boat. On the boat, we were mostly virgins. We talked about who we were going to be. Waitresses, seamstresses, nurses. We didn't talk about why we had to leave. We talked about where we were going to be. The wooden frame house with a picket fence. But we didn't talk about why we had to leave as we touched the lockets around our necks. The wooden frame house with a picket fence led to talk of lost villages, lost streets, as we touched the lockets around our necks. We didn't foresee tenements that grew thick as trees when we talked of lost villages, lost streets, and the diligent men we were going to marry. We didn't foresee tenements that grew thick as trees, the suitcase of memories we would have to carry to the diligent men we were going to marry when we were waitresses, seamstresses, nurses, nor the suitcase of memories we would have to carry from the boat where we were mostly virgins. We've had a bit of chat amongst ourselves, Louis and Rita, earlier, and I was outed as a Protestant. And then Louis mentioned that his wife is a Protestant. So I'm going to, this is for Shirley. And I guess for me, it's about I guess the lasting influence of religion in your life, even when you give it up intellectually, the emotional resonance that it has for me in my life. Sing. Let choirs make frosty nights sing. Let them tell stories of shepherds caring for sheep, a stable, a donkey, a star in the east, while you remember the road to the church in the woods, the battened door, timber trusses, peeling paint and plaster that fell like snow on the christening font and harmonium, the pot-bellied stove that offered a smidgen of heat, candlelight soft on the Bible lying open to Isaiah. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. Let yourself sing, diminuendo or crescendo, as if you still believed. So I'm going to read some new work next, but before I do that, I want to read the title poem of my collection, The River. I nearly always read it. It's like a good talisman for me. And before I read it, I do want to take this opportunity to say thank you to Neil and to all in Blood Axe Books, because I'm so grateful for the beautiful book they gave me and for all their support since its publication. I couldn't ask for more. The River. What surprises me now is not that you're gone, but how I go on without you. As if I had lost no more than a finger. My hand still strong, perhaps stronger, can do what it needs to. Like carving your name on a branch from the beach by the suck. Letting the river take you so I can call myself free. Only sometimes, like yesterday or the day before, last night or this morning, the river flows backwards, uphill to my door. So that one always makes me feel emotional somehow or other. Four Stories Up is a poem that's on the RTE website this week, Poem of the Week, and I'm reading it for Peter and Mary. Peter's my brother-in-law and Mary, his wife, who are here. They're from Dublin, but they're living in Bristol. And you see, this poem is Dublin in the summer, so that's why I'm reading it for the two of you. Four Stories Up. On a derelict building beside the canal, a gang of sinewy lads queues to dive. Cheers break out with every daredevil leap. They ignore the relics of trolleys, prams and bikes, the broken bottles beneath. They jump because it's summer, because it's hot, because of the girls that watch. They only need a clear run at the water. When I met Louis yesterday, we had a coffee and we were talking about some other projects we have in hand and sort of talking about our concerns. You know, the concerns when you're asked to do something and then there's your own work and which direction do you go in and how does what you're asked to do influence what you might be doing otherwise and all of that. But I'm working on a project of a sequence of poems in relation to World War One. And so I'm going to read... I'll read two of them this afternoon. After we're gone, farmers will level this ground, backfilling shell holes and trenches, picking coins, buttons, tin cups, bootlaces, shaving mugs, razors, from soil that has buried letters, curses, men and horses. They'll never know one of the lads keeps celandine and meadowsweet in a whiskey glass by his pallet. Another passes the time at the parapet, naming the flowers in his mother's garden. Foxgloves, lupins, heart's ease, sweet pea. When I try to forget the smell of fermenting flesh, I see neighbours with pitchforks, rakes and scythes between hedges scented by honeysuckle and wild rose. And the series that I'm doing, the sequence, is based on letters and photographs to do with a soldier and his sister. And his sister became, we heard about it in the cause, the session that was on here last night, became one of the land army. And she actually came to Malvern. And there's a photograph of her beside a Jersey cow in Malvern. Malvern. Far from piano practice in Hampstead, my days in Malvern begin and end with coaxing milk from a Jersey cow. Tall as my hip, the gentlest creature I've ever met, she waits by the manger while I, on a three-legged stool, tuck myself close to her belly, my legs hugging the bucket tight. I hold each udder between thumb and first finger, then squeeze. It takes time to find the flowing movement that'll release the milk. Meanwhile, my companion stands, her warm teats filling my hands, empty and cold for so long. So the last group of poems I'm going to read is a sequence about my father, and it's based on a lot of it from the last 2 months when we nursed him at home. But the first one is before he came home for his last 2 months. He stood at the top of the stairs, insisting he could go down himself. But like a frightened bullock refusing the crush, his body wouldn't move from the spot where I used to sit in the dark, listening to rows in the kitchen when my mother showed him the bill from the shop. He stood at the top of the stairs in a fever that came on him as fast as nightfall in winter. Steep, narrow steps between him and the ambulance ticking outside the back door. He stood there in checked pajamas and thick Wellington socks, in the house where he was born and had sworn he would never leave. I held him from behind, my brother in front, coaxing with a tenderness I'd never seen between them. Come on, Dad. Just one step. One step. When he falls asleep at the kitchen table and drops another cup, my mother bends without a word, sweeps up the broken pieces in her hands, looking out for shards in case he wanders barefoot in the night. I've got you. Through days of morphine, titbits to tempt his appetite, there's nowhere else to be. I hold his teacup to his lips, wash his face and the hands I rarely touched. During the night, old hurts and worries surface like stones in a well-tilled field. What time is it now? He asks, on the hour. He sings to himself and murmurs lines he learned as a child. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way. When he asks to get up, I hold his wrists, brace my weight against his. For a moment, he's confused. It's okay, Janie. I've got you. Go on now. You can stand. When Dad died, we had 2 days of wake. And because we knew there would be so many people and we had to divide it into 2 days. And still in all, we were amazed at how many came. And for me, it was something about how rural Ireland has changed incredibly. And it is so modern and it is still so traditional. And my brother-in-law, Peter, said it was a bit like a chieftain had died. This poem is about that time. And so this is my last poem. I forgot to look at the clock when I was starting, so I think it's about right. Okay. So again, just thank you very much. Yeah, to have such attention is wonderful, and to read to a big hall full of people is very invigorating. Respects. From Rooski, Cremulli, Lochglin, Kiltoom, Kilbegnet, Moylis, Brideswell, Le Carro, Craigs, At League, Ballinleg, Carrokeel. They came to pay their respects. They shook hands with us, stood by his body and bowed their heads. Cattlemen, sheepmen, carpenters, teachers, foresters, nurses, mart managers, vets. They said prayers, laid their hands on his chest and blessed themselves, then filled the kitchen with the man they knew, a grand man altogether, always out early, a hardy hoor, a good judge of a bullock, fierce man to work, a man of his word. He had woeful hands. I slipped out for a while to see the flawless orange globe hung low over the common and a flock of whooper swans feasting on the last of the winter grass. Thank you very much.
Thank you for that wonderful reading. Rita Ann Higgins writes provocative and heartwarming poems of high jinks and telling social comment. She's a gutsy, anarchic chronicler of Irish lives and foibles, mischievous and playful in their portrayal of feckless folk and outcasts, flirts and weasels, gas bags and scallywags. She left school at 14 and was in her late 20s when she started writing poetry. She's now published 11 books of poetry, including her selected poems, Throw in the Vows, which includes an audio CD of her reading poems from the book, and 2 later collections, Ireland is Changing Mother in 2011, and her latest book, Tunglish, which came out last year. Tunglish, I'm sure she'll explain further, is basically the language of sweet talk, babble and blather, quibble and quizzical. And Tunglish is spoken throughout that very lively book. Writing in the Irish Times, Fintan Toole wrote that it shouldn't be unusual to hear a smart, sassy, unabashed, female, working-class voice in Irish writing, but it is. Higgins is quite consciously an artistic outsider, a unique fusion of wry, deadpan humour on the one hand and absolute sincerity on the other. She has made what is still the most direct and powerful statement of the class divide in Irish society. She had a manic linguistic energy long before the hysteria of the Tiger era quickened the pulse of the culture as a whole. Higgins could be regarded in one of her guises as Ireland's first rapper. Her political satire hasn't lost its edge, But it no longer reads as a cry in the wilderness. Now the bubbles burst. We're left with our real treasures. And Rita Ann Higgins is one of them. Would you please welcome Rita Ann Higgins?
Thank you. Thanks very much, Neil. I thought you were making a run for it when it was my turn to read. When I saw him go out that door, I thought it was curtains for me and for him. Anyhow, it's very good to be here. I'm here for such a short time, but it feels like I've been here for ages already. I didn't think it was as warm as it is. And I didn't dress so much for warm. I had, especially the footwear, I had runners and I had high heels for today's reading with the salsa jeans, but we couldn't be doing that. So the woman in the house that I'm staying in gave me her dead mother's shoes. And they're absolutely brilliant, you know. And I love walking in them and I love wearing them. And I think it takes a special person to give you their dead mother's shoes. So I'm really grateful to her. Don't be put off by all the stuff I have in front of me. I always do that. I'll only dip in and out. So I'll read very few from Throw in the Vowels. And the first one I'd like to read is called Grandchildren, because I didn't have any grandchildren. And I wanted them so badly. And all of a sudden, all of a flash, I've got four. But when I wrote this poem, I didn't have any. Grandchildren. It's not just feasible at the moment, one daughter tells me. What with Seamus still robbing banks and ramming Garda vans when he gets emotional on a fish-free Friday in February. Maybe the other daughter could deliver. She thinks not. Not at the moment, anyway, while Thomas still has a few tattoos to get to cover any remaining signs that might link him with the rest of us. Just now, a B-52 bomber flies over on its way from Shannon to make a gulf in some nation's genealogy. The shadow it places on all our notions is crystal clear, and for a split of a second helping, it juxtaposes the pecking order. Now bank robbers and tattooers have as much or as little standing as popes and princes, and grandchildren become another lonely utterance, impossible to pronounce. So I have four now, and I'm just mental about them, as they say. And two, Jennifer had twins all of a flash, and then she had another baby after the twins. So she has, the twins are 18 months and the new baby. We always forget him because he's like, well, we don't really. We don't, but you know, he's there. We say, oh, pick up the child, play with that child. Somebody talk to that child, because the twins are, they're home wreckers. So he's 6 months, and then Oisín is eight. Anyway, this poem is called His Eyes Were Empty, and it's a poem about my father, and the I is the letter I in the title. And it's not true, the first line. I say the only thing I like about my father was his handwriting, but that isn't true, but that just worked in the poem. Hello. His eyes were empty. The only thing I liked about my father was his handwriting. His N's were slender and mean. They had big city written all over them. His R's were turned in, secret keepers that stole or owed nothing to chance or design. His ends were nowhere now, but they had travelled through continents of isolation and sting. His M's were memorable. His mother was free. She died before she could wing him a lullaby. His M's now mine to take or leave. I took a left and lost. The spines of his K's were sentinel straight, once teddy by wise, now corner men lonely. The watchers of history, the warmers of stone. His G's were fractured and cross, snarling like the Litchermore mongrels at the cheating half-days of winter. His eyes were empty, except for that gulf of longing that gaped around syllables, making contact a cavity language never reached. So I think I'll just leave that for now and go on to to Ireland is Changing Mother. The poem I'd like to read, the first poem I'd like to read from it is, whatever's behind this. Oh, it's Ireland is Changing Mother, the title poem. And there's no absolute nutters in this audience, so I can say we live in Castle Park, because sometimes people just rock up to your door and say, like, you know, it happens. It's happened to me a couple of times, and mostly just dropping in poems that they've written or that their kids have written. Stop fucking doing it. I'm busy. I can't cope with it. Anyway, so Ireland is Changing Mother. When I'm in my box room at home, there's a pitch just to my left, and I'll put a table there so I can look directly at it. And I said to Jennifer one day, I could hear the lads were playing football, and I could hear soccer, and I said to Jennifer, are one of the teams called the Taliban? Because I live in Ballyban, and more information that I shouldn't be giving out. So she said, yes, there's a team called the Ballyban Taliban. And when I was much, much younger, the mothers washed the steps. You know, the step in front of your house was scrubbed, and that was a great, you know, people were proud of how clean their steps were. Ireland is Changing Mother. Don't throw out the loaves with the dishes, mother. It's not the double take so much, it's that to take you by the double. And where have all the Nellies gone and all the Mrs. Kellys gone? You might have had the cleanest step on your street, but so what, mother? Nowadays, it's not the step, but the mile that matters. Meanwhile, the Ballyban Taliban are battling it out over that football that will bring the local yokels to a deeper meaning of over the barring it, and then some scarring will occur. As in cracked skull for your troubles. They don't just integrate, they limpigrate. Your sons are shrinking, mother. Before this, your sons were gods of that powerful thing, gods of the apron string. They could eat a horse, and they often did with your help, mother. Even Tim, who had a black belt and sleepwalking and borderlining, couldn't torch a cigarette, much less the wet haystack of desire. Even he can see. Ireland is changing, mother. Listen to Black Belt Tim, mother. When they breeze onto that pitch like some Namibian gods, the local girls wet themselves. They say in a hurry, oh my God, oh my God. Not good for your sons, mother, who claim to have invented everything from the earwig to the schlitter. They were used to seizing Cynthia's hips, looking into her eyes and saying, I'm Johnny come lately, love me. Now the Namibian gods and the Ballyban Taliban are bringing the local yokels to their menacing senses and scoring more goals than Cuchulain. Ireland is changing, mother. Tell yourself, tell your sons. So we go on here. I stole all these from my daughter's office in town. They're the greatest invention, these yokes, until they dry up. They're post-its or whatever they're... Anyway, he was no Lazarus. When I was a teenager, I worked in lots of shops and lots of factories, but I worked in this particular newsagent's at Eyre Square, and the Chantal fellas used to all come in because they'd all be going to jail. They'd be up in court, so then they'd come in and they'd go off on the train at 3:30 and you'd never see them again, you know. But anyway, I used to give them free cigarettes, because I thought that's what you do when you work in a shop. You know what I mean? You work in a shop, you give out free cigarettes. But anyway, I'm older now. Probably was dishonest. Shoot me. He was no Lazarus for Niall McMonagall. In the newsagents come bric-a-brac, days were spent gawking out, hoping the girls would come in for a chat or any old gossip that would help throttle a jaded afternoon. I smoked nearly as many cigarettes as I sold, and what I didn't sell, I gave away. The Chantal gang came in ones and twos. Give us a fag, Loveen, and I'd give them 20. Once I gave Elvis Kelly a yo-yo to pass the time until he went to England. I'll give you one long snake kiss for it, he said. They all went to England on the 3:30 out of Galway. We were like banshees crying over them. Then we lived for the SWALK letters. Harleston got him and plenty more besides. He drowned his sorrows in the green man, a right yo-yo. He fell under his own weight and broke his skull. A maverick blood vessel made the same noise as a cork. Pop went his flashlights and he all fell down. When he went down, he stayed down, ton of brick style. He was no Lazarus, no shape-changing Greek or Roman god. Abracadabra, now you see me, now you don't. He was no Zosima either, though he wore the brown scapular of Our Lady of Mount Carmel around his neck. He came home in a box, Spartan, no frills, just a shiny plate with his name, his date of birth. I was one long snake kiss out of pocket. And this green guy in here, what would that be? The Immortals. The Immortals. I'll drink out of your glass, Jane. I had TB, so you may not drink out of my glass, Louis. I'm better now. I used to be affected by the moon, but I'm better now. Whereas I live in the council estate, I'm spoiled, utterly useless, because people are always giving me houses. One time a woman gave me a house in Monaghan, but in Galway I had a cottage in Spittle for ages and ages, and now a good friend, when she goes back to Germany, she lets me have her house in Invern for the winter. And the family don't love it as much as me, because I love the language and everything like that, and they just make me get lonely so that I'll come home. And I always come home. Fuck it. What can you do? But anyway, the Immortals. So when I used to go down to the pub in Spittle, these little feckers would be flying in their souped-up cars, and they were joyriders and that. And actually, you don't hear so much of it anymore, but when I used to attend Irish classes, I'm the student that's learning Irish for 30-something years and still isn't fluent. But anyway, in the classes, the kids would come in, the youngsters, they were all youngsters, they'd come in, and there'd be so many missing from the class because one or two might have died at the weekend because of the joyriding or the boy racers. And after a reading, a woman from Finland gave me a small painting, and she said what they do here is they go out onto the lake with the car, and the ice breaks and the car goes down. So that's even sadder. The Immortals. The boy racers quicken on the Spittle Road in Barbie pink souped-ups or roulette red Honda Civics with few fault lines or facelifts to rev up about. Only an unwritten come hither of thrills with screeching propositions and no full stops if you are willing to ride the ride. Hop you in, filly, in my passion wagon. Loud music and cigarette butts are shafted into space. We'll speed hump it all the way, baby. Look at me, look at me. I'm young, I'm immortal, I'm free. Gemmas and Emmas, stick insects, are supermodels, regulars at Be a Diva for the perfect nails, eyebrows to slice bread with and landing strips to match. They wear short lives. They dream of never slowing downpours, while half-syllable after half-syllable jerk from their peak-capped idol's lips. Their skinny lovers melt into seats made for bigger men. Look at me, I'm young, I'm immortal, I'm free. The boy racers never grow older or fatter. On headstones made from Italian marble, they become our loving son Keith, our beloved son Jonathan, etc., etc. On the Spittle Road, itching to pass out the light, they become Zeus, Eros, Vulcan, Somnus. And the last one I'll read from Ireland is Changing Mother is No One Mentioned the Roofer. And this is about my son-in-law, who is actually really unwell and he's very young. He married Heather. He wasn't in the grandchildren poem because they were nice guys too. He's really ill, and I thought I was going to have to cancel because he's only 46 and he has stage 4 cancer, kidney, renal cancer, secondaries on the lung, and he's so young, and he's my my 8-year-old grandson's dad, and he went to hospital the day I was coming over, so I thought I was going to have to cancel, and then they just said, he's absolutely fine. It's all lies, but I'm going home tomorrow, so it'll be grand. So no one mentioned that he was a roofer, but then as an adult, he went back to college, and he got all straight A's in science through an adult education course. And anyway, but his job was a roofer. No one mentioned the roofer for Pat Mackey. We met the minister. We gave him buns. We admired his suit. The band played. We all clapped. No one mentioned the roofer whose overtime was cut, whose undertime was cut, whose fringe was cut, whose shoelaces were cut, whose job was lost. We searched for his job, but it had disappeared. One of us should have said, hey, minister, we like your suit, have a bun, where are our jobs? But there was no point. He was here on a bun-eating session, not a job-finding session. His hands were tied, his tongue a marshmallow. Thank you. So, I'm going to try a few new poems, because this is the tough thing about it. You have to always be writing stuff, and you have to try them out. And then I'll finish, after the new poems, I'll finish with a few filthy poems from Junglish. And just to give you a warning, in case you don't like filth, you could be getting ready to leave now, anytime. But anyway, I'll read a few of the new ones first. And the first one I'd like to read is called The Children of Sin. And, you know, if you've ever heard of Catherine Corliss, she was a local historian in Tuam. It's about the Tuam babies. And she discovered that all these babies went into this home. And where did they go after that? And what she did was she paid for the baptismals, the birth certs of the babies. So she could find out in that way. It was very clever of her. And she found out that nearly 670 babies had died in a fairly short period of time. And but that's really not so much about what the poem was about the children that did survive stayed in the home until they made their communion. And they had to go to school before the other children, and they had to leave before the other children. And they wore hobnail boots. So people would be indoors and they would hear them. The children of sin. The children of sin are out again, out from behind the 10-foot wall. They march to school, that's a hobnail rule. The march of the hobnail beat can be heard on the street, in the houses, in the memory, in the long, tired memory. No need for anyone to look out. They know that sound. The hobnail memory makes a hobnail sound. The children are on the march in their hobnail boots. They arrive 10 minutes late. They leave 10 minutes early. If you were bold, you were threatened with the seat by a home baby, a home alone baby, a nobody home baby. A home baby carried the sin of the mother. The priest and nun always win against the sexual sin. From school, they march back in their hobnail boots. 5 or 6 years old, the children of sin march home again. They march in behind the wall, the 10-foot wall, until tomorrow, when they march out again, the children of sin. And then, when they grow up, a lot of the children were sent to places like Letterfrack or other institutions, you know, industrial schools. And there's something called the redress board, where they give them some money, very little money, but they give them things like cookers, or they get your teeth fixed, or, you know, it's so patronising, it's unbelievable. And the redress board get plenty of money, but one day I heard a programme and all these people who had been in institutions were ringing up saying how they were humiliated when they started to ring up and try to get some of the things that were due to them. So the CEO, her name is Higgins, no relation, I hope. Anyway, the poem is called It Suits a Narrative. It suits a narrative of the big bad state, and the big bad religious congregations. Mary Higgins, CEO of Cara Nua, the Irish Times, March the 20th, 2017. And Cara Nua means new friend. So here we go. Some applicants will never be happy, and grievances suit a narrative of the big bad church and the big bad state and the big bad building with the big bad gate. We ration our compassion while all ye say suits a narrative of the big bad state. We ration our compassion, but we'll give you a couch. We ration our compassion, but we'll give you new windows. We are the keepers of the church's money. We divvy it up. We divvy it out in dribs and drabs. We won't give you money, but we'll give you new teeth, a new radiator, a brand new funeral. It's not that we want your pain to be everlasting. By the same token, it suits a narrative for ye to come on here and complain and say we have no compassion. We have oodles of it, but we ration our compassion. If we give you stuff without humiliating you, it won't feel right. You ask, we give, or maybe we won't. Still, so fill that form and then fill another and another and another. And one for your sister and one for your brother. And while you're at it, one for your mother. Don't listen to the guy who said criminal records are given out like Holy Communion to people in institutions. We all know he stole an apple. Otherwise, why would he have been there? Some applicants will never be happy. And it suits a narrative of the big bad church and the big bad state and the big bad building with the big bad gate. Thank you. So I'll just do another, maybe one of the new ones. And I'll do the trespass against us, because this was a leaked memo from the HSC, that's like the health board, and they said to nurses, this went out to nurses, this went out to hospitals all over the place, and they said to nurses, you know, patients who've been there for a while are just trespassers. You can use minimum force to get them out of the beds. So this is the new one, and then I'll finish with the other ones. They trespass against us. The memo said, get them out of that bed. Make Lazarus out of the lot of them. By the head or the knee, a puck in the back, a knuckle in the nuts, a sweeping ankle throw, but no bruises. They trespass against us. Minimum force at all times, except at tea times. Give them nothing, no tea, no ham. Give them spam, they trespass against us. Unwilling or unable, get them out of that bed. Fed or unfed, get them out of that bed. But no bruises. Infirm or inform, who cares if they're warm, they trespass against us. They are blocking our beds, get them out on their heads, they trespass against us. Memo meant for senior management eyes only. Written by their legal team. Paid to be mean. Paid but not seen, they trespass against us. Now, I'll just finish up with a few poems. I think I'll just limit you to three because it's hot, you know. I'll limit you to three of these dirty ones because it's not good to come to Ledbury reading filth. Filth is bad. So what happened was, Tungalish is really the mildest of them, like, because that was the sequence started with Tunglish, and Tunglish is very mild. But the word Tunglish comes from Tung and Ghoulish, merging the two words together and leaving out the U, or leaving out the GH, the H in Ghoulish, so you don't have, you don't say Tung Ghoulish, you say Tunglish. And I went to Rome with my daughter, and I love walking tours. And I then wrote the sequence about Rome. Well, I went home and read anybody I could, you know, read Mary Beard, read anybody that wrote about Killigilla and the bios. So I just hope the daughters never read them. But there's no fear of it, because they never read poetry anyway. You know, we heard you were great at such a thing, but they wouldn't, you know, that's as far as it goes. Anyway, I'll start with Killigilla, because he was pretty badass. You've had all my handmaids. You think they don't tell me. They tell me everything. You forget about Nemesne. She clocks up all your putrid deeds. Now you sprawl there with that wine goblet in your hand, your red lips. You look more like me than me. Will you drink it or throw it? Madness in your eyes. I know some depraved stuff is cooking. The eyes never lie. Before this, you were never bothered much with Cuntus, a rear ender like the rest. You look at the grapes and you mad eye me, all in one sycophantic blink. You fiddle with my toga using that emperor toe. Your aim is good for one so riddled with venom. Why can't you be more like Benedict, who warded off lust against his holy sister Scholastica by rolling around naked in nettles and thorns, emperor of evil with chiffon sanity? You boast to the menfolk our private deeds, Beelzebub. If I pop those grapes, you'll dunk your nut, as if Cuntus was vile and a favour bestowed. You forget about Nemesne. She forgets nothing. She'll turn you into a horny toad, or a double take, or better still, a lost look. Now, Nero features in this one, and he was pretty bad as well, you may say. An octave higher. Sometimes you take me by surprise, but nearly always from behind. You don't even take off that armour when you take me, lover. The incantation from the racket is deafening. But it's not without a curious comfort, an ancient lullaby, calamitous fuck. And Jove knows it's heavy as our sins, and we do sin often of an afternoon. O emperor of darkness, O cunning fuck, toss me with your Herculean strength, that I may glimpse your vacuous eyes. Your sandals drenched again, no doubt you are flailing about in the Tiber, taking down a few Christians for spree. On your way to take me, godling, what gets into you? When you bite my nape with such gusto, after me soaking for hours in ass's milk, I snap momentarily. Slap wouldn't have been out of place there either. I snap momentarily, more from startle than from sting. When I shudder from the draught in the vestibule, even if we ever reach the bedchamber, it will be a miracle. You think it's because of you, egomaniac, and you plunge deeper. I snap again, an octave higher. I say, basta, Nero, basta. You never listen. So I'm going to finish. I have enough of them now, because the day is too hot. So I'm going to finish with this, The Women of 1916. And thanks a million. And it was absolutely great. I'm lucky I'm staying so near that I just ran up and had a shower before the reading, so I might have to do the same now. But thanks, you've been tremendous, and good to see you. I hope to see you some other time. The Women of 1916. The state recognises that by her life within the home, Article 41.2.1, the Irish Constitution. Years before the offending article was even conjured up by De Valera and the very Reverend John Charles McQuaid, with the help of a pack of Jesuits, the plan was set in train to banish these biddies back to their kitchen sinks. The banishing tool of choice was the airbrush. The Women of 1916 did not sit back and wait in the wings of history with tricolour dribblers to mop up the runny eggs from the chins of the rebels. These unmanageables were there from the start. They could knit a 32-county Ireland in plain and pearl with their eyes closed and never drop a stitch while rearing 7 sons and as many daughters. The rifles they held were not for showing but for using. The handgun could nestle on a hip or be tucked into a petticoat, Webley, Colt, Smith or Wesson. Winnie with the Webley Kearney was one of the last people out of the GPO, revolver in one hand, typewriter in the other. I write it out in a verse. Lily O'Brennan, Constance Markovich, Helena Maloney, Ellie Nellan Gifford, Mae Moore, Rosie Hackett, Dr. Kathleen Glynn, Margaret Skinner, Rose McNamara, Nell Ryan, Lizzie Mulhall, Kathleen Kitty Fleming. Whenever green dresses are worn, some tricolour dribblers spill scorn. Thanks a million. Garamila Markov. Thank you. Thanks a million.
Thor his Louis de Puer, aher locha anuf. Gives me great pleasure to introduce Louis de Puer, one of Ireland's leading Irish language poets. He was a key figure in the Irish language poetry renaissance of the 80s and 90s. He's worked closely on English translations of his poetry, with his co-translators fully engaging with the original poem in Irish. Keenly aware of the more destructive aspects of translation, he and his trio of translators, Kevin Anderson, Biddy Jenkinson and Mary O'Donoghue, have eschewed the modern fashion for so-called versions, producing English translations which are as close as possible to the original Irish poems without sacrificing their tone, energy, clarity and lightness of touch. And today you'll be able to hear him reading his poems in Irish and English. The latest dual language edition of his poetry is The Brindled Cat and The Nightingale's Tongue, which takes its title from a poet by Jerry Murphy called Translation and Its Discontents. Just a three-line poem, I think, unless there's more. Stark moonlit silence. The brindled cat is chewing the nightingale's tongue. His selected poems in Irish was recently voted one of the top 10 collections in Irish since the turn of the millennium. And his bilingual anthology, Liara na Hafala, Poems of Repossession, published last year, continues the line of English of Irish language poetry where Thomas Kinsella's earlier anthology, Poems of the Dispossessed, from 1981, left off. And I'm sure Louis will say something about his editing and translation process, as well as reading you some of the poems in English and Irish. So would you please welcome Louis de Puer.
Gurmila Mahagiv, delighted to be here and especially pleased to be here with Jane and with Rhiannon. And I was particularly pleased that Rhiannon finished with a poem on the women of 1916 because I'd already in my mind decided to change the order of poems I was going to read a poem that I had written, which also relates to 1916. If you're unaware of it, Ireland had quite an extraordinary year last year as we marked the centenary of the Easter Rising of 1916, which ultimately led to independence. But it was an extraordinary year, not least because there was such a determination on the part of our government and official Ireland to insist on the pastness of the past, to make sure that we were commemorating a long-gone history, but not to move from that to an interrogation of the extent to which contemporary Ireland has become so much less than the vision to which those who were involved in the 1916 Rising aspired. It's a much lesser place than the Ireland that they would have dreamed for us. And central to the 1916 Rising was a man called Padraig Pearse. He was the leader of the rebels. He was a revolutionary thinker on education, pioneered what we would now call child-centred education in Ireland, a reasonable poet in the English language, but quite an extraordinary poet in the Irish language, the first modern lyric poet in the language. And one of his most famous poems is a poem called Misha Éire. And my poem is a kind of a response to that. So I'll just give you Pearse's poem first. It's very short and then go on to mine. Two characters mentioned in Pearse's poem. Cú Chulainn is the greatest hero of Irish mythology, a male hero. And the Hag of Bear is quite an extraordinary figure. One of the great Irish language poems is attributed to her. Amongst other things, it might be one of the oldest poems in any language about female menopause. But the Hag of Bear is a Christian woman at the end of her life looking forward to the Christian hereafter. But she has very powerful memories of an earlier time in her life when she was almost certainly a fertility goddess. And it's about the doubleness of the early Irish imagination, which is both pagan and Christian. And Pearse seeks to revive that in this really short poem called Misha Éire. Misha Éire, Shinneme nan chalach vera, Moor Mogloir, me the rug cu chulling croga, Moor Monair, Machlown fain, the yeel a mahir, Misha Éire, Uigni me nan chalach vera. I am Ireland, I am older than the Hag of Bear. I am Ireland, great my glory, it was I who gave birth to brave Cú Chulainn. I am Ireland, great my shame, my own children betrayed their mother. I am Ireland, and more lonely than the Hag of Beara. Shinge era, shinishing na kuchulling is an chalach vera, na na flaha farev arshan riv eag the Christ. Shinge era, oigishing na an piersach is o kneela, na childers a chrelive lo son na squeele. We are Ireland, older than kuchulling and the hag of Beara, than the chieftains our ancestors served before the death of Christ. We are Ireland, younger than Pierce and Connolly, than Childers who shook hands with his own executioners. We are those who went away and those who remained, those who came and stayed. We are the sons and daughters of all the dreamers. Our dreams may yet become us. It has a little card with that poem on it that's available at the back if anybody wants to take a copy of it. So I go from that to a poem called An Tauranee, the Singer. And it's kind of one of those poems that happens not nearly often enough where things seem to just fall into your lap in a nice and orderly way. And the poem happened really on a particular night in a particular place, listening to a particular singer, and everything that's in the poem either happened on that night in that place, in the room, or in one of the songs, or in my head. And if I've done my job properly, you shouldn't be able to tell which is which. So the idea here is that imagination is an extension of and part of reality rather than something that evades reality. I'll do the first part of it in Irish, then the translation, and come back to the Irish. Istoilish a mertos machor, gurlioson of ain a lauren, nor a chanan a gultri graver, is fada le barra a mare, gomeshit savalia, is cad shanama erichelico, gomaidin. Is at le hain a rhine, is le hir lianain, gomach faun brishta grihe, var a hanga, eg far nor casagor a hanna. Nor a vuilin a srangan a shiade, a changil da chela an chied la riaviad, dridden an lanuin fosta da maiachas a lehe chela. Nor a chimlian, illing a lane a shud, le guling a vana, buinen farog ar hevel an tomra a yanzi saurig do, is iran ar arati an tassi shlu in anam dealish day. Guian an kailin a will oilacht an vroin in a gnush, gomeseg an chela, nu gavayashe I. These two here in front of me think he's singing to only them. When he plays a loving lament, their fingers ache to be home where they can play on each other until morning. The lonely and the old flames are amazed. A man they've never met has the broken tunes of their dreams off by heart on the tip of his tongue. When he touches the strings that tie them together the first time ever, the married couple in the corner move closer in spite of themselves. When the sleeve of the man's shirt brushes his wife's shoulder, a young fella at the other end of the room takes off his summer jumper and asks the barman to turn the heat down for God Almighty's sake. The girl, made lovely by sorrow, prays he'll never rest until he finds her. Outside, a fleet of sirens storms the night, squad cars, ambulances and fire brigades running from the fire that can't be put out, in the smouldering hearts of the men inside, who are late again for the never-ending funeral. Beside the bridge, the Morse code of loneliness, broadcast on flurries of air, is clear as day to the man who has just jumped. The water is smooth as a sheet, and he is deaf to the world as the music fills his mouth, washing away a world of worries. The singer keeps on strumming the strings that stretch from the heart to the mouth of his guitar. His cry is soft as the river, a blanket of water drawn up over all our sleepy heads. Tan tishke chomín le barilín is thaun aling an chioil in a veil a vaura vuir of an tail. Lianan an kioltor is shemant ar na srangan a fulla a hín an ongrig a di bail a guitar. Tá chuoine chó séh le plid na haan á tharingt os ar gún go léir. I spent a time, nearly 10 years and all, living in Australia, and spent a lot of time also in Tasmania in particular, and there's a poem called Ilon Bruni, or on Bruni Island, which is just off the coast of Tasmania, and it's dedicated to Peter Hay and Richard Flanagan. Peter Hay was an extraordinary activist, environmentalist, poet, historian, and mentor to younger writers, myself included, but also Richard Flanagan, who won the Booker Prize some years ago. And if, like me, you're occasionally prone to agnosticism or even atheism about the virtues of the novel, I think Richard's novel is one of the most extraordinary novels to come out for a very long time, a reassurance that the novel is capable of confronting the world rather than fleeing from the world, which as often as not seems to me is what the novel does especially well recently. But The Narrow Road to the True North is an absolutely extraordinary novel based on his father's story. So this poem, the location for it is Richard's house in Bruny Island. And there's a reference here also to an account by George Orwell of a hanging, a very famous account, quite extraordinary, moving and very powerfully real account, made all the more extraordinary by the fact that we know that Orwell wasn't there at that particular hanging. So I suppose, again, it's a poem, it's a contemplation about imagination and reality, but it's also, like a lot of the poems I'm writing recently, circling around the idea of relationships with fathers. On Bruny Island, there was wine and beer on the table, fine talk about books and politics and history, about people we couldn't figure out, God help them, when we got word that the father of the man of the house was about to return to the red earth that made him almost 100 years before. It occurred to no one to say a prayer, but the talk turned to boats, to friends who would gladly drive through the night, to the place where a little trapdoor of light had opened between now and infinity. I thought of Orwell's story about the misfortunate man on his way to the gallows who skipped over a puddle he saw between him and the scaffold where the hangman and the priest were waiting. And it occurred to the one who understood better than any writer before or since what it's actually like to be tired out, knotted with hunger first thing in the morning, that no one really credits his own death till the earth opens beneath him as he falls through the tiniest gap between now and nothing. Orwell wasn't there when that man was hanged, but he walked with him, step by step in his head, hands tied behind his back, the soldier's boots creaking in the wet sand on either side of him, skipping the filthy puddle we all see just in front of us, as each of us walks to where his own father is in two minds between here and hereafter, praying he'll step over the dirty water one last time before his feet are finally bathed. The remarkable thing in Orwell's account is the man who's going to his own death jumps across a puddle, the last thing you'd imagine he'd be concerned about, but clearly is still some, there's still some hope that he might not be dead very shortly. Maybe I'll go from that to a couple of other poems which are about fathers as well. Two short poems, one called Bells or Cligini in Irish, and I'll follow that immediately with a poem called Luas Gáin. And amongst the other things I was trying to do in these poems was trying to see how you could flatten language as much as you possibly could to the most ordinary mundane words and still see what they were capable of carrying, what kind of freight, emotional freight, even the simplest, most unadorned language could carry. So I'll read Cligini first. Tan vaidin cho socker a gonamara, go glushin Cligin on ifig a buola, a gloss on togali, la vila on dig. On vashta cho hetrum, gomrahin giran oil maher, a se smitha blockan a aimud, er chul and tea a gorkig. Nur glean mavam on gishtin, arien she a vaher fein, or all in a aher, tachtestach an a yin air, saravuroche. Tá sé demlíon a dhíis is tá athair cho garaddó lena chrecin féin. An bhaidin cho socar, go gosin sé cligín ifige in aigine a bhic, blianta fadó bhaile. Ar áleis, go le róhan diantage go fóil, teacht isteach an is sar a bhúró sé. Bells. This morning is so quiet in Connemara, I I can hear the office bell ringing in the builder's yard half a mile from here. The rain, so light, I feel my father's heavy breath as he chops wooden blocks behind the house in Cork. When my mother calls out from the kitchen, he hears his own mother telling his father to come in for his dinner before it gets cold. He's 10 years old, and his father is as close to him now as his own skin. The morning, so still, he hears an office bell in his son's head, years away from home, telling him he's done enough for now to come in before he goes cold. Swings. In the empty garden, there's a blue swing barely moving, and no one pushing it since the wind got tired of its childish, thankless work. Don't move yet, I tell the child in my mind. Don't let on you can do it yourself. Till you feel his hand at your back, his voice pretending to be cross as he tells you, you're old enough now to be able to push yourself as high as you want to without anyone having to push you. Of course, I say to the father in my mind, and his son looking out through the half-drawn blind at a blue swing still moving, but only just in the empty garden with no one to push it, no one at all. And maybe something just a little bit more cheerful. John Banville has said somewhere that it's not true that writers write their way out of depressions and all of the rest of it. He says that's the worst time to write black things, that if you're writing really horrifying things, as he is prone to do, it's better to do that when you're in a very stable state. So I'd like it to be understood that if many of these poems are very bleak, it's because I'm a very happy person. So this poem is, nonetheless, we were talking earlier, actually, during the week, myself and Jane, just about why it is that poetry, apart from festivals like this, remains marginal in most people's lives, except in extreme moments. Like, why is it that people in prison resort to poetry? Why is it that at funerals people want poems? You know, what William Carlos Williams said still holds true, that poetry accomplishes nothing, but men die every day for want of what is found there. But it's certainly the case that I have a lot more poems that are suitable for funerals than for weddings. So there's a clue there. But so I'm very happy to have written this poem, which is, I think, suitable for weddings. Maybe I'll just read the translation. It's called Rhododendrons. In the empty church by the waterfall, a young couple from Mullingar walk the narrow aisle of happiness for the first time since the wedding. Their eyes have grown accustomed to the semi-dark as they approach in their denim jeans the altar where the perpetual light of hope still flickers. The scent of rhododendrons blows through a small hole in the stained glass of their memory, and the bride is having trouble lighting her white candle at the railings. All around, the air is on fire, and her hand shakes as it did that day the future placed its old gold ring on her finger. Her husband catches her moist hand, and the hot tears of the candle scald his soft skin. The rhododendrons breathe a fragrant sigh. They can't wait for another wedding to go to in their lovely purple dresses. Another visit to Australia, maybe, a poem called Didgeridoo, which I'll read both in Irish and in English, if I may. I used to be more confident introducing this poem that I was clear about what it said to me, at least, which is not always the same as what it might say to other people. But I still think that there's something in the poem that suggests that there's a point beyond which you cannot enter and inhabit fully another culture or language, and that it's the point at which you come up against the wall that separates you from French or German or whatever it happens to be, that actually should be the basis for our understanding of tolerance and diversity, that it's not about blurring the lines between one culture, one set of religious beliefs or none, and another that is a confirmation of our humanity. It's the extent to which we're able to acknowledge things we don't understand. That seems, at least to me, to be what's coming out of this particular poem, which came out of my attempt to try and understand the music of the didgeridoo when I lived in Australia. The didgeridoo can play two notes only, but for anybody who's attuned to it or lives within its acoustic, that there's a whole music there and a whole world, but I could never hear it because my acoustic is entirely different. So this is didgeridoo. Ní valig an ciol seo nathar ní an ís as íochtar cishán da bhuilig le brothal seanama na mro aon teo chrasach. Ní chur sé de chos cheanarcach a step rinc ar leac gan baiachas da daigina cheartaseach le sprawn tais na gasfort cahach. Má hasan tú gan chur ar fa second of oin nú míle blian, chur sé alta le réan a nadú i measc na guach i de chléan old caum, paróidí, gorama, glasa, daraga ar de ghuilí loiscithe, is cucubar a nigoidach a funoid fe de chosa gala. Beg trefna ors an air a cletarnach tímpalort, a lorcat de mail rá ná tigan de chrí, gaulghaelach, bán. Má hasan tú ghaithiad blian na géistucht, cloisir ceol stair a chine a sile as onahar paulta, gear ghaba éan a cnaga pleasc a snap a miun chnáv, agus dór na gala ar sínsir cnasta a buala chrecin na talún mar a bheith bauran na mahian fach. Just the bauran is the Irish drum, which I'm sure you know anyway. This music is not played to lure a snake from the woven basket of your distended belly with a heat wave of torrid notes and swooning melodies. It won't set your rebel foot tapping on stone to taunt your straight-jacketed intellect with squalls of hornpipes and twisting slides. If you stand and listen for a second or a thousand years, lyrebirds will nest in the devious loops of your branching hair. Blue, green and red parrots will perch on your scalded shoulders, and a sarcastic kookaburra make fun of your scorched white feet. You'll hear parakeets and lorikeets flutter round your head, ancient tribes of the air speaking a language your wild colonial heart cannot comprehend. If you can stand for a minute or 200 years, you'll hear the songs of his people bleed from a punctured lung, sharp beaks, pecking skulls, snapping small bones, while the bright fists of our gentle ancestors beat the skin of the earth like a bowron that feels nothing. And maybe two love poems to finish with. This one is, I'll just read this in translation because it's slightly longer than the other. It's called Multitasking. There's a reference in it to a novel by John Banville. The novel is Birchwood, an extraordinary novel set in 19th century Ireland. But there's a moment in it where there's a character in an Anglo-Irish mansion who's about to step out through the French doors into the lawn outside, and he changes his mind at the last minute, but has this extraordinary sense thereafter that his whole life was transformed by that single act, that he had a choice between one future and another and rejected the better one by not going through the windows. So it's included here. And the first time I ever read the poem was at the Flat Lake Festival in Ireland, amazing festival run by Pat McCabe, who wrote The Butcher Boy. And I was introducing the poem in this hay barn, the butty barn, he called it, and people were sitting on bales of hay. And just as I started to talk about John Banville, Banville walked across the front of the stage, clutching a bottle of Chablis. Nothing else would do him. And it was a fairly intimidating moment, I have to say. But I persisted. So, yeah. Multitasking, at which famously, of course, women are better than men. There's no point telling me it's a trick, the light and dust made up to deceive me, that it was your reflection I saw in the window as I washed the dishes this morning, listening to the radio in the corner while you ironed children's clothes, half listening to me as usual, giving out about the world and its ways. No, I wasn't dreaming. I saw you clear as day with my own two eyes, going past the gable end of the house just now, when I knew in my mind you were there behind me, letting on to be listening to me and the dead radio. For the sake of peace, I didn't bother glancing sideways over my shoulder to try and catch you inside and out at one and the same time. After 25 years and more of this, I know it's no bother at all to you to be there alongside me and away somewhere else I can't follow you. unlike your man in Banville's novel, who's about to go through the French doors in the Anglo-Irish mansion when he turned back at the last moment and was afflicted by the most incredible loneliness for the rest of his life, for the person he might have become had he stepped through the glass door between him and himself. You, on the other hand, can be there and not there, inside and out, whenever you like, coming and going as you please through the window I never closed between you and yourself, just in case you might want to follow her, the young woman who went out through the French doors all those years ago and is still waiting there at the gable wall. I hear you singing quietly behind me, a sure sign you're in with yourself again. When the singing stops, I feel your eyes go right through me as I stare out the window at the woman I've been following all my life and never managed to catch up with. If I went as far as the gable wall, my love, it's unlikely I'd ever turn back. And just to finish up with a poem called Marmalade. Just to echo perhaps what Jane said earlier, it's just such a great thing for all three of us to be published by Blood Axe. There's a real sense you're in the big leagues when you get to be a Blood Axe author, and I can't think of anybody who's done more for poetry and has a more generous, open approach to the whole world of poetry and the whole world through poetry than Neil Astley. So it's just wonderful to have him as a mentor to us all. So this poem is called Marmalade, and I'll read it in English first because I'd like to finish with the Irish. I open the jar of marmalade and morning fills with the bitter, no sweet taste of Algiers, Morocco, Seville, where fragrant bombs hang from tree branches. When they burst on the bare ground, I like the ones with blood in them best. The air is scorched all around with the noise of revolution and street markets in places I have never been, but still my nose remembers their bitter, no sweet smell. When I return to the kitchen, worn out from wandering beyond the borders of the senses, get real, you say, frowning. I bought those oranges yesterday in the butcher's, and it was I who made your marmalade, bitter sweet, the way you like it. Exactly, I say, as your body's fragrance detonates, burning the air all around me. The riot has already started in the street market of my heart, just there beside the stall of oranges. Buine machapin den broca suvaroiste is lianan an vaidin de vla sharav niha milish Algiers, Morocco, Seville, mar will buami cura crochta yegan a groan. Nor a fliascan a dal of bawn, ni keen will rian fullatri his dishilum. Lushter an tair moor himpel le glory of loide is maragi sraida in aitin an arawis riev ach ar queen le marhon ar a hunson am la sharav ni ha milish. Nur ilim an gishtin treacht ag master har teoring na gied fwi morhua de chion bocht ar satusa agus pusort I shupan vush dair a chanis na harash dishin an e agus misha mehen a yin de chid marmalade milish agus sharav maras maliate. Godirach a derimse, agus buami cura de cholinga a lushk an air im himpel. Tan reav loid tosna hanna im maraga sraid im achri, dirach an eke le shastan na narash di. Grimila mahagwif. Thank you. Thank you.